Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In today's episode, we speak with Heather Elkington, TEDx speaker, writer, coach, and founder of Fresh Leadership World. We talk about her varied career from the Harrods shop floor to scaling a multi-million pound SaaS business and the leadership lessons along the way. Well, welcome, Heather. We are so pleased to have you with us this morning. I want to talk a little bit about your journey. I think it's a nice starting point because you have had a varied journey from working on the shop floor in Harrods to exiting a SaaS business to now working with leaders. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey and almost the mindset shifts that were needed for those different environments, because they're very different to each other?
Yeah, of course. So absolutely, my proper career started, I would say, on the Harrods shop floor. And the reason I say proper is because I'd had lots and lots of jobs before then, like kind of just collecting titles and industries through waitressing to retail and everything in between. And so I came out of uni, my first proper job was assistant manager on the Harrods shop floor. At the time, I'd say my mindset was very much fear. Like, I was just terrified. I was scared. Whilst I was at Harrods, that world was very much about perfection of standards. And so everything, you had to look perfect, act perfect, dress perfectly. And I experienced the type of management, which I think a lot of people are in today, which is just from like the place of fear, the place of scarcity, where you're constantly just fearful of something going wrong, fearful of making mistakes, saying the wrong thing. And as a result, we kind of go into a bit of a shell of ourselves and we don't experiment. We don't feel safe to try new things. We don't feel safe to have difficult conversations. And so my mindset at Harrods, and definitely as well for the 2-3 years after that, in the world of management, was one from a place of fear. As I left Harrods, moved into a SaaS business, software as a service business, and then into another software as a service business, where I went from marketing executive, marketing manager, through to ops director. And the big mindset shift that I had to, the big journey, I guess, that I had to go on from right at the beginning of being in that fearful place was just one of abundance and kind of letting go of the idea that we need perfection, letting go of the idea that we, as managers, we have to know everything and have all the answers and not make mistakes, and just learning that we too are not experts, we're not perfect, we don't have to get everything right. And it's definitely served me really well. It absolutely means we'll make more mistakes. It means we will fail more, but it also means that we will grow more, learn more, just innovate more, create a safer space for our team, because when we feel safe to fail, so do they. And so the biggest mindset shift that I've been on over the course of those years of promotions and growth is definitely moving from a mindset of fear into a mindset of abundance and being able to think, there is good things in the world. It's okay to fail. And another big part of that was not seeing growth as a competition. And I think I speak to a lot of corporate leaders now, a lot of managers in corporate, who to them, if someone in their team started to outgrow them or started to become better than them, they would see that as competition. When actually, our team growing at a rate faster than us is exactly what we want. We want them to become the experts in their field. We want them to be better than us at the things they do. And if that means they get promoted higher than us or end up earning more money, great. It's not a competition. We will also get there, maybe just not as fast. And I had to really undo a lot of learning, probably from school and just like growing up in a capitalist society that pits us all against each other, especially women, that when we get into the world of work, success and growth isn't a competition, and there is room for everyone to win. And we actually will win and go further for longer when we can see our peers and our team as equals and people who we want as much growth for as we do for ourselves, and start to give out those opportunities and grow other people around us. And so, yeah, they were definitely the two big mindset shifts. It all goes back to that feeling of just abundance and growth and commitment to making mistakes and experimenting and learning and letting go of the idea of being perfect versus being in a world that's fearful and scary, and we're kind of hoarding things and like hoarding money and promotions and titles and thinking no one else can get them, because if they do, it means I can't, when that's just not the truth.
That's such a lovely lesson and message, isn't it? Because we see so often with managers that we're working with, it's almost like it's understanding as well, like if your team succeeds, that's a reflection of you and your leadership. And it almost is this piece of like, well, I need to be seen as the person who needs to be recognized. And actually, if your team are being recognized, that can only do good things for you as the manager and the leader of that team. And it's almost that think that dropping of competition and comparison is such an important message, because it just gets in your way. When you're doing things from an ego place or a place of fear, you make the wrong decisions. You're often driven by emotion versus what you should be doing in that situation. So I think that's a really nice message that brings.
It's a lovely message, but I can tell from what you're saying that it's been a journey. And you know, you've mentioned before early on in your career, struggling with that imposter syndrome piece. And often that's the bit that gets in the way of all the things you've just been describing. What did you discover about managing those feelings, and how do you help others now manage that and recognize them in themselves and overcoming that as a challenge?
Yeah, the way I've overcome imposter syndrome in my own career is two main things. Firstly, seeing that my whatever the thing I felt the most vulnerable about at any given time was actually my superpower. And for me, at different stages of my career, that was often my age. It was that I was younger than people, or my experience, that I was less experienced than the people around me. Or I, like, even when I was down in London, the fact that I had a Northern accent, like, that was a real vulnerability for me at one point, to the point where I would, like, try and change the way I spoke. I was convinced that people thought I was stupid. But every time I've had like a big vulnerability at work, it's always in hindsight been the thing that was my superpower. So for example, when I was the only Northerner in a small office, that's what I was kind of like seen as being special for. Like people saw me as really down to earth, really trustworthy, really friendly. And it was actually a superpower, and I think a well needed like energy shift in the office, that I was the one that was kind of willing to be very just vulnerable and friendly and kind, whereas I would just feel really insecure about that. And it's only in hindsight that I've kind of seen that that was a superpower and something I should have been proud of at the time. In relation to my age, you know, I've sat in many boardrooms in corporate scenarios where it's just me surrounded by 15 men or 20 people who are two decades older than me at minimum. And the level of imposter syndrome that I felt in those scenarios is like crippling. But as I moved through and was sat in more of those situations, had more of those experiences, I started to see that actually there's a reason I'm in this room. There's a reason I've been given this position. And that's because I am inexperienced, because I am younger. And they need that, you know, we need diverse opinions in this room. And some of that diversity comes from age, and it comes from experience and different levels of it. And we need it at all different stages. And so a big one for me in overcoming imposter syndrome was just realizing, I still use this to this day, if there's something I feel vulnerable about, insecure about, that makes me feel like I don't fit in or feel like I'm in the wrong place, I just reframe my thinking to actually this thing I feel vulnerable about is probably the reason why I'm here, and probably the thing that other people see in me that they think that makes maybe them feel insecure about the opposite trait that they may have. So there's that one. The second thing, which we've touched on a little bit already, is adopting a mindset that doesn't care about perfection. And I am actually naturally not someone who's very attention to detail perfectionist anyway. And so this shift was one of the easier ones for me, I guess, in that I started to see when I was having difficult conversations in the early days, I would avoid having them for fear that, like, what if I say the wrong thing? Or what if a team member comes back and says to me, well, you're wrong, or has a bit of, you know, is a bit conflicting, or comes back to me with something that I'm not going to be able to answer, in quotation marks. And all of that is just perfectionism getting in the way, because that's essentially your inner monologue saying to you, don't have this conversation because there's a tiny chance that you won't get it perfect. There's a tiny chance that there'll be a question you won't be able to answer, or a piece of new information that you won't be able to deal with. And so instead, I now just go into all of those conversations thinking, yeah, I'm probably not going to know it all. There might be a question that I'm stumped with. And if that happens, I am now comfortable enough to go, yeah, this is new information. Let me take it away and have a think about it. Or I don't actually know the answer to that question. All I can say to you is, you made me feel like X, Y, and Z. That's why we're having this uncomfortable conversation right now. And if you don't feel the same, then we can have a conversation about that another time. But I need you to accept responsibility for the way that you've made me or someone else feel. And so just really moving into like a growth over perfection mindset in every single thing that I did. Difficult conversations being one. Getting work out there being one. Like, being in a marketing role is one of the most difficult, I always think, because your work in an organization is the work, is some of the only work that is on show for everyone to see. Yeah, so visible. And so when you're in the world of marketing, every single person in that organization, from the CEO to juniors to graduates to developers, customer success, your customers, your clients, prospects, everyone can see your work and everyone will have an opinion on it. And when you're in a marketing role, perfectionism can so easily like stunt your ability to get things out the door and get things done, especially if you're in an organization where you before have had an experience where someone has come back to you, like if your work is already out the door and the CEO comes knocking and says, why has that ad campaign gone out? Or why is this? And you then have to explain yourself 10 different ways. And that originally, like back in the day, would get me into a real place of fear of like, I need to get approval for everything. I need to run it by people. I don't want to put it out until it's been tried, tested, and it's perfect. When in reality, like, all that does is stop you being agile. It means you can't be reactive. It means you can't be creative. You can't test and experiment and try new things, which is how you win in marketing. Like, those, that's how you win. And if you get into a place as a marketing manager where you don't do any of those things because you are so focused on perfection and getting everything right, it's just not going to work. You're going to ultimately fail at the one thing you're brought in to do. So just getting really comfortable knowing that actually when this work goes out, the CEO might come knocking on my door and say, why on earth has that gone out to our customers? And you having the confidence to say, either explain yourself or just say, yeah, it's just a test. Might not be perfect, but we'll let you know. You know, we've got to do that. That's how we win in marketing. And I'll let you know the outcome. And so just, so accepting that my greatest vulnerabilities are often my biggest superpower, and also accepting that in any given situation, from difficult conversations to putting your work out there, it is growth we're looking for. It's always going to be messy. We're not seeking perfection.
And I think that ability to reframe can be so empowering for people. I know we talk a lot with regards to imposter syndrome around, if the aim isn't never to feel it, I think people feel like, you know, we often get questions around, well, how do I just not get this? How do I just get rid of the self-doubt and get rid of the imposter syndrome? And ultimately, if you're not experiencing any growth, you likely won't be experiencing imposter syndrome. To us, that imposter syndrome, to your point around being your superpower, absolutely. And it's a sign that you're growing. Because if you're putting yourself in situations where you feel uncomfortable, where you feel like an imposter, where you feel like you are a fraud, you know, because it's something new, then actually the whole point of that is that you are then growing. So that reframe, I think, can be so powerful in the stuff that actually for, especially new managers, can feel quite crippling. You mentioned there about difficult conversations, and that's probably the one thing that
and you probably get the same, that we get the most questions about from managers and leaders that we work with. What do you think, in your experience, is the key to transforming those difficult conversations from unproductive, where often people will have a conversation but it doesn't really drive the outcome or they avoid it entirely, to actually having a really constructive, difficult conversation that drives results?
In my experience, actually, the biggest problem that we face isn't necessarily people having those difficult conversations and they're not being productive, but it is, in fact, them avoiding them in the first place, to the point where if you avoid that a conversation that may have been something that could have been nipped in the bud, something that could have been dealt with really quickly, if you avoid that in 2 months, 6 months, 2 years' time, that is going to be something that when you have to have that conversation, it's not going to be very productive and you're not going to get great results because it's been left to fester for so long. And so the first thing I always say when we start talking about difficult conversations is, if you can just not avoid it ever, you're already winning. Like, you're already, and in fact, as a manager, if there was one thing I could get all managers across the globe to take away that would immediately level up how much impact they can have with their team, how much results they can drive, how happy their team can feel, if there was one thing I could say, it would be just never avoid a difficult conversation. And so firstly, never avoid it. The only time I would say to delay it, and take this with a huge pinch of salt, because this is like one in every 100 conversations, is if you are in a highly emotional state. So like if something's said or done that makes you really angry or really upset or even really excited, just, it might be that sometimes I just needed 5 minutes in a meeting room to just sit down and let my feelings just cool off. That's all I needed, just that 5 minutes. But sometimes you do need to sleep on it. And so just know when you're in those highly emotional situations, but otherwise just have it straight away and in the moment. That's one way you're going to get the most impact from the conversations, is having it in the moment, because both parties, you and whoever you're talking to, will be able to remember the situation really clearly. So I always think it's so unfair when managers wait a month or even sometimes a whole blooming year to have an appraisal in which they'll build up all this feedback and difficult thing, and then they'll sit down with them in this yearly appraisal or monthly whatever and go, so yeah, that thing you said back in July, and you've turned up to 7 meetings late and X, Y, and Z. And it's like, it's so unfair on the team member, because you could have just told them when it happened and they might have been able to pick up on the behavior, notice what was wrong and correct it quite simply and quickly. Whereas now you've been holding on to all this negativity, you're telling them and they could be sat there like, what? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't understand. I don't know what you mean.
And it erodes that trust, doesn't it? It's like, it's just, because then they're sat there thinking, well, you've just been judging me and then banking all of these things. And let's be honest, it doesn't work for you as the manager either, does it? Because the likelihood is you're frustrated. They're not performing at the level that you need them to perform. And that whole thought process of clear is kind, be clear, give people the feedback, let them then do something with it. And if they don't do something with it, then fair enough. But you've put it all out there.
Definitely. And some of the people often say to me, like in coaching calls, is, oh, well, I've got a one-on-one with them on Friday. Shall I save it to them? I'm like, no, even if it's 24 hours before, like, tell them now, because all you're going to do as a manager, it's unfair on you as well, because all you're going to do is work yourself up about it. You're going to make it harder to say out loud. If you just nip it in the bud, they can hear it, do something about it, and then you can have a more productive conversation in that one-on-one, because you can just follow up on it.
If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviours and the behaviours of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform. Those words, managers just seem to avoid them, which none of us wants to have those sorts of conversations, do we? But I watched once, and you've probably seen it, it's done the rounds, of this example of a difficult conversation where the two people left with such vastly different experiences of that conversation. And it really came down to the manager was talking in a very nuanced way. They were giving feedback that was almost quite softly, it was quite disguised. The person left thinking they were doing a good job. And it was like, well, how did that happen? And it was because they weren't using just very plain, straight language. They weren't clear about the consequence. And actually, that's then where those blurry lines come in. How do you give that in a way that actually the person can walk away without any doubts about that?
I think the consequence bit is critical, absolutely critical. Just to bring in the behaviours, because some of this is more difficult for people with certain behavioural traits and strengths. So if you are very, very people-centric, you will struggle more naturally to be directive, because you want the person, you want to be kind. And I know that's a really important piece around how you promote really good management, is like that being kind, creating safe space. But sometimes what happens is people take that too far, where it almost feels like just a conversation, or and it's too softly, or it's just not directive enough that the consequence is obvious. But people do that intentionally, where they make it sound, they soften it, they soften the blow, thinking they're being kinder.
They want to still be liked, don't they?
Yeah, still a sense of belonging, still being liked, and that people please bit. If you've got, you know, it's interesting because your motivation is split across all three motivations. It's relatively evenly split, but there's a motivation called affiliation, which is where you are very people-centric. You're the person that creates very much the sense of belonging, the team spirit, and you're motivated by your impact on others. Now, you've got 33% of that, so you've got a big dollop of it. But if you're a manager who's maybe dominant in that, like 70% plus, those kind of conversations are going to be way more difficult for you. And I think this is where, and on the other end, if you're more achievement driven, you might just talk about the goal and what someone needs to achieve and take all of the emotional intelligence out of it and the empathy out of it. It's striking the balance right. And I think the other thing is making sure that you loop back on the consequence conversation, because we've definitely find that people forget to do the loop back because they're so busy, they go off and they forget to pick it up until the next appraisal, which is 3 months down the line or 6 months down the line. And actually you're pulling out the pieces of paper to remind yourself of what the conversation was. I'd be interested to know a little bit about how do you have that ethos around creating the safe space, being kind, and all the things you've talked about, but also focusing on driving up performance in a management team. You've obviously worked with lots of leaders. How do you get around that?
So that something you mentioned there about like delivering it, essentially sugarcoating feedback so that it doesn't hurt people's feelings as much. We all heard of the shit sandwich. I feel like that's one of those concepts in management that was taught decades ago that just still remains to this day. And to me, a shit sandwich is one of the most dangerous ways of giving feedback. Because like you said, people can leave that conversation with very different opinions of what just happened. So it's super dangerous. And it's almost pointless. It's manipulative and pointless. Jim Scott, the woman who wrote Radical Candor, yeah, so just guru of difficult conversations, an icon in the leadership world, she calls it ruinous empathy. So ruinous empathy is where we have great intentions for our team. We are incredibly empathetic. We love them. We want the best for them. We want to talk to them about these things. But our commitment to not hurting people's feelings and not making someone upset, essentially our empathy, gets in the way of ever enabling that person to grow. And so the question you just asked there around how do you find the balance between sort of being that people-centric, human-led versus delivering results, to me, they are the same thing. So like you can, of course there's a balance, but I think if you were to lean really far the other way, in that you didn't care about people and all you cared about was driving results and KPIs and business, blah, 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 that would be the worst thing to do to drive results for a business, because you're essentially, like the definition of a company, if you Google the word company, is a group of people. And as a job, as a leader, our job is to ensure that that group of people, as individual needs are all met, that whatever they need, like accessibility wise, is all like used to level them up, you know, all their individual superpowers that they have vulnerabilities about, we make them feel safe about those things and can communicate their own needs and can give feedback. And like when we focus on creating that as a culture, the business looks after itself. And like, this is something that I have massive experience with already, because at Go Proposal, which was the startup that we built and sold to Sage, I was the ops director. Now, if you think about what an ops director is by name and by trade, like if you Google it and look at all the definitions and process at docs, etc., an ops director is someone who increases efficiency. So it's someone who like goes into the processes and systems of the business and increases the efficiency of them. So how can we make money faster? How can we smooth out our supply chain or whatever? But what I found in a very short space of time was that my time was wasted on the systems that were essentially like on the outside of the business. So, okay, I could make a conversion of an email chain better, or I could, I don't know, make a client onboarding process slicker or HR policies better. But actually, I had experts in all those things. I had a HR expert. I had a customer success expert. I had an engineering expert. Why on earth am I trying to do them? All I need to do is make sure that my group of people feel so safe, feel so looked after, love coming to work, feel happy. Because when they feel like that, they will make the systems more efficient. They look after them because they feel safe too. They try new things. They innovate. They care about the business because the business cares about them ultimately. Like, I was someone who was running the show and cared deeply that my people came into work feeling happy, feeling excited, feeling fulfilled, like had a purpose. And that purpose doesn't have to be like the business purpose. I knew what their individual goals were, and I could help them achieve them through the company. And as a result of that, all the stuff that an ops director normally does in terms of systems, processes, etc., were dealt with by the team. So grow the people will grow the systems. And it was just, yeah, so like for me, those two things, like the business needs, driving a business forward, making more money, we absolutely flew in terms of like, if you look at all the stats for businesses, how quick you can exit, how quick you can get to the £1 million revenue mark, how fast you can, I don't know, like the profit margins, the EMPS culture scores, engagement scores, we were world-class in absolutely everything that we did. And I know for a fact it was so closely linked to the fact that culture and people was the utmost priority on our list. It was everything, core values, like investing in people, growing people, make sure people were paid properly, like making sure we knew their individual success paths and what they wanted for their family and their life and how we as a company could help them get there. The rest of the stuff, the team did it because they loved working there. And so honestly, for me, like those two things just go hand in hand. And I think the empathetic leaders, as long as we are aware of how ruinous empathy can be, in that we have to commit to, like, if you really care about people, you'll tell them the difficult stuff. You won't hide it from them. And as long as we remember that and keep that in mind, you will be like head and shoulders above the rest because the business will take care of itself.
And it's interesting because I have a similar role in our business where I lead on the customer success stuff, the ops side of the stuff. But in exactly what you're saying, if you looked on paper, I'm non-procedural, I'm non-detail. So you would actually think, well, that's not the best position. But when Laura and I were looking at, you know, divvying up at accountabilities, it was like, it's actually made more sense for me to do it because I'd be driving the people who were doing it, who were good at those things.
I was working on some stuff for a retreat that we're running in a couple of weeks. And we were talking about, if you read Rocket Fuel, and the idea of the visionary and the integrator. And that integrator person is typically ops related. And there's almost this trend now that's moving towards integrators being less about the high process, high detail, and actually more about the people. Because really, if you look at the definition of an integrator's role, it's to integrate the vision and to drive it forward. But if you're in a people business, which let's be honest, you look at businesses, 98% of them, whether they think they are or not, are people businesses. Even if you're selling a product, people are making it, people are selling it, people are marketing it. that integrator role, to me, having that people focus is far more important than someone who's high process, high detail, but doesn't have the empathy piece. Okay, your processes might be optimized and you might be efficient in so far as how you execute things, but if the people aren't engaged and they're not the ones that are driving that efficiency, you've lost. You've lost half the battle.
Absolutely. The best book I ever read that showed me how powerful focusing on solid leadership really can be was No Rules Rules, the Netflix culture of reinvention. So it's written by one of the Netflix co-founders, and he explained how in their sort of real breaking point era, as in when they were taking over Blockbuster and whether or not they were going to make it as the streaming platform they are today, the only way they could turn around their business, because there was a point where Netflix was failing, there was a point where Netflix wasn't going to become what it was today, and they had to make some huge cultural shifts. And the only reason they could make that breakthrough was by reinventing the culture and by focusing more on the people, giving them more freedom, more information, more opportunity. And only when they did that, did the business then take care of itself. And so, yeah, I'd even say, you said 80% of businesses, I would say 100% of businesses are people businesses.
You're not wrong. And that to me, when you think about Netflix and you think about that freedom and responsibility culture, those two words together are not often related, because people almost think, well, if you give them the freedom, they won't be responsible. But actually, if you give them the freedom, they're more likely to be responsible. And that's the balance of what you were saying before about the empathy and the accountability, that actually the two can exist alongside each other.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I just, and there is a level, you will get employees that don't take to those things. You will, without sugarcoating what I'm trying to say, you will get employees that take the piss. You're going to get those people. And it's for you to just decide, what kind of humans do you want in your business? And if they're not the kind, there is a place for people who we kind of expect, and I definitely got into this trap at some point, maybe in the middle of my leadership career, assuming that everyone wanted the same thing as me. So I was really career driven, ambitious, driven by money, promotions, shamelessly so. And I just kind of assumed that everyone was the same and assumed that everyone would enter the career ladder and have these big dreams of CEO and climbing to the top. And it took a lot of work for me to realize that not only does everyone absolutely not want those things, but actually that the people who don't want those things are just as valid and important as the rest of us. And we still need to make sure that those people are looked after, paid properly, given the right training, set up for success, etc. And so yeah, it was, there will be people who take the piss. I ran this. So a lot of the work I do is culture transformation through long, strong leadership principles. And I was working with a top 100 accountancy firm. I've just finished up a project with them in which we've built out some core values and actually built all the systems that the team now use to ensure that those core values are used across the business. And one of the core values that the team came up with, because they have to come from the team, so I can't just come in as an external consultant and tell them what the core values are. They have to come from the team. I'm very much the facilitator, the integrator, and the team give me the information, and it's driven from the bottom up. And one of the values that the team came up with was flexibility with focus. And so it's this idea that as a business, they are incredibly flexible. They do flexi time, compressed hours, they do a 4-day work week. They are incredibly flexible, but they'd been so flexible over the last 5 years that they actually gotten to a point where they'd started bringing people into the business who had expected it, and as a result weren't kind of performing under those conditions. We had 90% of people in the business who did, and then this 10% of people who didn't. And so they wanted a core value that helped to show the business will give you everything if you can just focus just for the hours you work. We don't expect anything outside of that. But if you can give us full focus and accountability and commitment whilst you're in work. And so it was this idea of I think the exact core value is balance, freedom with focus. That was it. And so it was like, the business will give you everything, but we do expect that focus in return and commitment to, whilst you're here, you also want in the business to succeed.
And I think that, again, that just, it summarizes that piece, doesn't it, around that two things can coexist. It doesn't have to be one or the other. You know, we talk a lot about cozy culture. We talk a lot about, you know, when we talk about motivations, obviously on the behavioral side, there's 18 different workplace dimensions that we look at. But we always say, if you're going to start somewhere, start a motivation. Because if you can motivate your team, if you understand what drives them, if you understand what gives them energy, if you understand the stuff that lights them up every day, and you can align your management with that, you have already gone halfway there. Yes, there's all these other pieces, but actually, if you could drive that motivation, that's such a huge starting point. Just to wrap up, because I feel like we could talk about all of this all day with you. Out of all of your experiences, what do you think, if you were talking to new managers, what do you think is the most important lesson about leadership is that you would want to translate to them?
Definitely one that we've already touched on, which would be never avoid difficult conversations. I guess the second thing that I'd love to tell all new managers is that you don't, when you're promoted into a new management position, you don't owe anything more than you already are. So people get promoted into positions generally because they are already incredible. And what I see is, and this is so many people who like come through my education, DM me, like come onto my course, will say, I just feel like I'm not, like I've been given this position and now I need to be more. And so often I'm like, all I want to say to them is, everything you are right now is enough. And someone has promoted you because they already can see what you are doing is great leadership. And so, yes, we have to get them practical skills. Yes, we have to help them with their mindset. Yes, they're going to level up over the course of years. But I wish, like, if I was to go back to even five years ago me, or definitely 8 years ago me, I would be like, you right now are enough to do this role. And you don't need to be constantly wishing you were better, wishing you were more, wishing you were older, wishing you had more experience. Like, everything you've already got inside you is enough to do a really good job. And we still commit to learning, like still commit to growing and leveling up and being better, but don't do that at the expense of your mental health and just the respect and love you have for yourself and the kindness that you have for yourself. Because we have to know that you're in that position because you deserve it. You're in that position because someone has seen something in you that's brilliant. You don't immediately, the day you get that role, have to become more or someone different or change who you are. Even if, and like this is when it gets tricky, I think, and I've been through this, is when you are promoted into a position that now you manage your friends. So like, say you've been in a peer-to-peer relationship before, and now all of a sudden you're a manager. So many people are like, I need to change. I need to change who I am. I need to do things differently. And of course, there's going to be some things that will change. And yes, you need to do things differently. But you don't need to come into work the next Monday an entirely new person, making different decisions and like looking at things differently. It's, you can still be who you are. It's okay.
Absolutely. Well, what a lovely lesson to leave on. But thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, this is our favorite topic to talk about, as I know that it is yours as well. So this has been a really lovely conversation.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's wrap up with some key takeaways from today's episode with Heather. The first is, if you really want to focus on how you improve from difficult conversations, just focus on having more of them. So really thinking about when you have things that come up with your team members, having those difficult conversations in the moment versus letting them go on and fester. When you're then in that difficult conversation, making sure that you very clearly outline what are the consequences of that person's behavior not changing, so that they walk away really understanding what's going to happen if they don't change their behavior. And finally, we talked about the concept of ruinous empathy from radical candor. and actually really just making sure that if you are more of a people-focused manager, where you have those people behaviours, you're higher external, you love to work in proximity to others, you've got that high affiliate people motivation, making sure that you balance that empathy with still being able to have those hard accountability-driven conversations.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.